Hello everybody and welcome to this, the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike. I am Mike and with me as always is Hannah. How are you this evening?
I am well, thank you. And you?
I'm good on this sweltering hot December evening. Being in New Zealand, of course, Christmas is a warm season, which may come as a bit of a surprise to people in other parts of the world, particularly in England. I'm sure I'm going to get Paul on my other podcast complaining about the weather tomorrow morning when we record that.
Our children have been swimming today in 26 degree heat.
Yeah.
Although it is forecast rain next week. So, you know.
Well,
it's not quite full on summer just yet.
We have flung the windows and the doors open and we are going to do a little bit of podcasting and a little bit of television watching. So, what television are we watching this evening, Hannah?
I thought we'd watch EastEnders.
Cool, okay. It's a bit of a left
Phil
turn.
But Mitchell has a crack problem.
Do you know, that's the second time you brought up Phil Mitchell on this podcast.
Is it?
Yeah.
When else did I bring it up? I can't remember,
but it was the other week you brought up Phil Mitchell. And
what did I say?
I can't remember. We were talking about soap opera storylines or something.
Well, because he had one of the biggest storylines in EastEnders history.
But I'm not judging. I'm just saying this is the second time.
It's like who shot JR.
Yeah, but regardless, it's the second time you brought up Phil Mitchell on the podcast, and I just think that that's interesting because...
Are you trying to say I fancy Phil Mitchell?
That had not even occurred to me, Hannah, until now.
I thought it had this, like, bouquet of...
No. I don't hear Phil Mitchell mentioned very often in conversation, and when I hear him brought up twice in relatively quick succession, I notice and remark.
I jest. We're watching Twin Peaks. We're watching the third episode, The Man Behind the Glass. Synopsis says, Renette is attacked in her hospital bed by an unseen person. Jean Renault, brother of Jacques and Bernard, plans to blackmail Ben Horn for the release of Audrey. Donna meets with Harold Smith, a shut-in who had befriended Laura. It is directed by Leslie Linker Glatter and written by Robert Engels.
All right, looking forward to this one. A couple of quick bits of housekeeping. First and foremost, a reminder that if you listen to us on YouTube, you can leave comments there and we will read them out as feedback, or alternatively, or in addition, you can email us at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. You can either send us voicemail or a traditional email, whatever floats your boat. Also, please do give us 5-star reviews on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts, or on whatever your podcaster of choice is. Quick reminder, actually, that if you do listen to us on YouTube, that this is available as a regular podcast as well. I forget to mention that sometimes. We are on Spotify Podcasts, so just go on there, or again, whatever your podcaster of choice is, and you can set us to follow our feed there. That's just another option as to how you can consume this podcast. And speaking of which, please do check out our friend shows, namely Chinstroker versus Punter, his film, her movie, The Good, the Bad, and the Odd, Film Bastards, and Talk Without Rhythm, start with. And Video Landfill as well. And we are also on Instagram and Twitter, where in both instances we are at Rewatch Proj. So, Hannah, do we have any feedback this edition?
We do. We've got an email from our good buddy Alex in LA.
Okay.
And Alex, you made me laugh with your sign off. You'll see why in a minute. Hey guys, Alex here again. Thanks for reading my last email. I haven't seen Rings of Power, but we'll give it a go. Glad Hannah is enjoying X-Files. That and Twin Peaks feel like sister shows to a degree, particularly once you get into season 2 of Peaks and the other world starts to encroach a little more. Agree about Don Davis. That guy, I think, is such an amazing storyteller. If you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend the TV series Stargate SG-1. Along with Farscape, it is one of the great 90s sci-fi shows that I haven't heard you talk about. And along with Farscape, it's such fun. Davis is really prominent in it and essentially plays Major Briggs. Big recommend. Curious to hear if you have seen either of those shows is listening to you. I know you will love them, Mike. And I don't know if that's what you've signed off or if half of the email got missed off.
Oh, like, yeah. Mike, I think all of your points are intelligent and well considered. No, thank you for that. That was, sorry, who wrote that again?
It was Alex. From LA.
I don't remember us mentioning Rings of Power or Ring of Power. Where did that come from?
When we were talking about scores.
Oh, yes.
TV music. Yes. And I said how it was awesome in Rings of Power.
Ah, yes. Okay.
And weirdly, we're doing a annual rewatch of Lord of the Rings at the moment, and we've both remarked so much on how having watched the first season of Rings of Power, how much it affects your viewing of Lord of the Rings in a positive way. Just the detail and nuance it brings to...
it does what a good prequel should do, isn't it? Yeah. Which is it enriches the tapestry of what you're watching.
Honestly, Alex, it's great, and you should definitely give it a whirl and let us know what you think of it.
Yeah. I've not really watched Stargate. I know the film.
I've watched the film, but yeah, I haven't watched the TV show.
I've watched a bunch of the first season, and I enjoyed it. But it was one of those shows where it's the only one of the big 90s sci-fi shows, like 90s and 2000s sci-fi shows I haven't watched. And I think what it was I'm quite a social TV watcher. Mm. I like to watch shows either with somebody or in tandem with somebody. So I've got
someone to talk to about it.
And at the time, I think Stargate was on when I was at university. And nobody I knew was watching it, so I kind of didn't. And I've gone back. I've had a couple of goes at watching the first season, and I liked it, and I didn't stop watching because I didn't. But it's just one of those things where if you haven't got that motivation, it's a tricky one. But yeah, Don Davis is in that playing a general, I think. So, yeah, he's definitely typecast in a good way, I think.
That I'd put it on my list. I think that would be a good one to have a look at. Farscape is on my list as well.
I didn't even hear he mentioned Farscape. Sorry.
You said along with Farscape, it is one of the great 90s.
Yeah, no, I have seen Farscape and I adore it. For me, it's part of the I guess, for 90s sci-fi for me, there's Deep Space Nine, The X-Files, Babylon 5 and Farscape. They're like the big four.
So I watched the pilot of Farscape after we finished Babylon 5. I feel like this has come up before,
actually, on the podcast.
Yeah, it might have been Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. We talked about it. I watched the pilot of Farscape after we'd finished watching all of Babylon 5.
Oh, yeah.
And I can see, like, it's something I'm going to come back to, but I really was not in the right frame of mind for it when I watched it.
Well, you're in the frame of mind for Babylon 5.
Yeah. I couldn't connect with it on that, and Mike, you said to me at the time, because were we wrapping Christmas presents or birthday presents?
We were half
for somebody?
Watching it, yeah.
Yeah. It was like, yeah, this is not the right time.
The thing about Farscape is it has classic 90s sci-fi first season syndrome. Because the thing about Farscape is it was produced by the Henson Company, the Puppeteers.
Mm.
So when it started...
It does have a Muppets vibe.
It is the Muppets. It's Henson.
I know.
But it was when the show started, it was very much a showcase for the Henson special effects house. Mm. And that element dominates the first season quite a bit and really doesn't afterwards. And don't get me wrong, the first season's still good, but that can take a little bit of getting used to. It's a little bit like the kind of PlayStation 1 CG for the first season of Babylon 5.
Yeah.
If you can just see past that into the characters and the storytelling and the performances, it's a wonderful show, and I know you'd love it because it's very character driven, and it's a bit like Babylon 5 in the way that you get characters not reversed, but grow and change in ways where when you, by the time you're a few seasons in, you look back at the first season and think, wow, gosh, I can't believe where we've come from.
Londo and Jakar.
Exactly. It's that kind of thing. So I think you'd really like, and also the other great thing about Farscape, it has a really satisfying conclusion.
Well, it gets you know how much I like things getting wrapped up.
Is it gets wrapped up so nicely. Mm. And going into a show knowing that, which we didn't know at the time when it was on, because it got cancelled at the end of the fourth season on a cliffhanger, but they came back and did a four-hour miniseries to wrap it all up, and it wraps it all up really well. And also, it was made in Australia, so it's packed full of Kiwis and Aussies as well, so I think you'll enjoy it. There's a lot of Shortland Street in there.
There's a lot of Dr. Guy Warner. Yeah.
But also with that comes the quirkiness that comes with a little bit of like Hercules and Xena, a bit of that insanity. Because the thing about Farscape, it's ironic considering it's, you know, came from the Henson House, is it's got a really almost kinky undercurrent to it that none of the other 90s sci-fi shows have. That's really unique, and but I think you really enjoy it. But you would have to go into it knowing that you got to kind of get through it a little bit to get to the good stuff, but it's worth it.
Yeah, you know? Well, that's not something that bothers me. No, in general.
But it's never boring. I mean, even in those early episodes where you're kind of like, oh, okay, this feels a bit like, you know, Pigs in Space kind of. There's enough funny stuff and humour and kind of very straight away, it's really obvious that they're telling a big ongoing storyline. So there's stuff in there that will keep you going. But I think you'll like it purely because it's so 90s sci-fi. It's so Star Trek.
Just on the, you know, Australia, New Zealand of it all, did you hear there's been a casting call for Zombies 4 in New Zealand?
Zombies 4? What's Zombies 1, 2, 3?
You know, one of our daughters.
Oh, the Disney kids films.
Yeah. They're looking for kids aged 8 to 14.
Oh, you got to do it.
Oh, I'm not putting Chloe forward.
It'll be all stage school kids, right?
It says they have to have exceptional dance, singing, and acting.
What are you saying, Hannah? Our kids might come back and listen to this one day.
I'm saying that they're enthusiastic.
Yeah.
And that's great.
Yeah. Like their mum.
Like their mum, they sing with passion.
Yes. But no, thank you for that feedback. We really appreciated it. And if there was more to your email that...
send it through. It feels like it finished abruptly.
Yeah, I feel like there was maybe a copy and paste fail there of sorts. Premature hitting event.
There's nothing on the email that says to download the rest of the message. Yeah. Or I've had a good look at it, but no, it just looks like you've been thinking of Mike when you signed it off.
Oh, bless. Well...
maybe you were.
He's only human. Or she. We still don't know.
This is true.
Maybe that was it, Mike. He was like, oh, so close to finding out. But no, we appreciate that, Alex. Yes, rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. Should we hit pause and watch Twin Peaks?
Indeed.
Okay, we'll be back to tell you what we thought of this episode very soon.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
So we have just finished watching the third episode of season two of Twin Peaks. Hannah, initial thoughts on this episode?
I really loved this episode because I feel like it moves things on again. Like there's some momentum with finding out aspects of Laura, finding out a bit about what the giant has been referring to. I just think it has like quite a good momentum from start to finish this episode.
Yes.
And I really enjoyed it. What about you?
Yeah, it does that thing we've talked before about how, because this is the first episode of this season not directed by David Lynch. And, you know, what the show often does is Lynch kind of comes in and gives all of this sort of dense symbology and abstractions. And then it's kind of the show's job then to sort of unpack that.
Symbology. And
figure it out. And this episode does that. This episode is unpacking that and kind of giving meaning to that and trying to figure it out, you know. And but also, I think because this is the first episode of the season not directed by David Lynch, it sees a welcome return of some of the elements of the show that David Lynch doesn't have interest in, which is some of the broader soap operatic elements and the kind of the sort of, for want of a better word, more frivolous elements of the show.
The detriment of it all.
Exactly. but I really like those elements of the show.
Yeah.
And it's great when David Lynch or Mark Frost or one of the key kind of key holders of the show does an episode, because you know you're going to get pure sort of unfiltered canon and mythology.
Yeah.
But at the same time, part of Twin Peaks for me is just these little sketch show, you know, kind of like what shows like Portlandia do, you know, where it's just this sort of, and Hannah's been rewatching Schitt's Creek recently. And that's a weird town show as well. And some elements of that show feel just completely superfluous, but beautifully superfluous and add to the tapestry of it. So I feel like this episode it's not one of my favourite episodes of Twin Peaks, but I think in some ways it's a perfect episode of Twin Peaks because it does both. You've got all of the stuff with the one-armed man. And Leland really getting into the sort of guts of what the show's about, you know, this larger, you know, good and evil. But at the same time, you've got Dick Tremayne, you know, being a cad and apologising by offering 20% discounts.
Delicious things like preggers.
Yeah, exactly. And he has great lines of dialogue in the show. Like there's one later where... and apparently the actor did improvise this we don't worry about spoilers, so I'll just say it, but there's a silly plot line later on where the same Save the Pine Weasel campaign that they run, and Dick says to somebody, don't you think that using a stuffed animal to symbolize a ecological initiative constitutes the ultimate incongruity? Shit like that is just so delicious. And he knows he's cleverer than everyone else, but he's also dumber than everyone else because
he's a fucking idiot.
Well, he's intelligent in a schooled way, but he's doesn't know anything about the world.
Yeah.
You know, whereas like, you know, I mean, like David Lynch talked about how
my engine reconditioning father would say about him, bloody academic. I bet he's a lecturer at a university.
And that's a very Lynchian thing as well, because when David Lynch was on Scene by Scene with, what's his name? The film critic, with the Scottish film critic who I love and I hear his voice in my head. Paul's a big fan of his.
The Northern Irish guy.
Yeah, I can't believe I can't remember his name.
Mark Cousins.
He got into like a bit of an argument, but a discussion with David Lynch when he did a one-hour interview with him. And he was talking about Alvin Strait from The Strait Story and about how, you know, he had travelled, he'd gone overseas, he'd been in the army, but he lived in his small town and that he had a very small view of the world. And Lynch took real umbrage to that and said, just because you haven't travelled or you haven't had education or worldliness doesn't mean you don't understand the human experience. And he talked about the character of George Bailey, the Jimmy Stewart character in It's a Wonderful Life, and how he never left town. You know, his character was in Bedford Falls his entire life, but he had a rich, full human experience.
Yeah.
And that's something that you can tell when Lynch is interviewed is really important to him, and he feels quite strongly about that. You don't have to have been all over the world and been to university to know the score. And I think that that's something that you see a little bit of.
I've worked at a university, but I've never studied at one. And I think I'm fairly intelligent.
Well, I mean, it's one, neither's better.
And I have travelled a good part of the world.
Well, you've lived as far away from your homeland as is possible. So have I.
Yeah, but I would say the one thing that gave me in my 20s was anxiety.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But so it's not always a good thing.
No, no, no. But
I mean, that's not to say there isn't great things about doing all that stuff, but what I'm trying to say is I get what David Lynch is saying. Yeah.
And it's funny as well because, I mean, this episode does show some of the elements, the superfluous elements that people would be critical of later in the show. And I think that it's a little bit unfair because I think the only time that that's an issue is there's about a 2 or 3 episode run where, because it was mandated to them to wrap up certain storylines early, they were scrambling for a couple of episodes. So all you have is those superfluous storylines for a couple of episodes. And I think that's the thing, is that when they're just one of the flavors of the show, it's fine.
Mm.
You know, but like any flavor, to continue this, you know, metaphor, if you've got too much of it, you know, it's overpowering.
Too much of a good thing.
It doesn't work. Mm. It's got to be balanced. Well, should we get into it? So we open up with Ronette kicking off, and we see that the killer, it would seem, has paid her a visit. There's, Albert, Truman and Cooper are on the scene, and somebody has tampered with her IV, and they find another letter under her fingernail. We later learn that that letter was cut out of Fleshworld.
Yes.
Cooper tells Harry and Albert about the Giants and how he's paid him a visit as well. And is it Albert who's like, is he any relation to the dwarf?
The dwarf.
Which is a fair question.
That did make me chuckle.
We're introduced to the character of Harold Smith, played by Lenny Von Dolan. And
do I know him from?
It's driving me mad because he's not really been in much else, but he really reminds me of somebody. It's not what else was he in? It's who does he remind me of? He's really similar to someone, and I feel like I'm going to remember it at some point. But so he's the shut-in that we learnt about from the grandmother and the grandson, the magician, and
the spookily David Lynch lookalike.
Yes, yes, child. Absolutely. The little Lynch,
little Lynch,
the mini me, and I love how awkward he is. Like, he offers her all this weird food, and then he's like
apple butter.
Yeah, and would you like to wash your hands? You
know? Yeah, I felt like the response to that should be, would you like me to wash my hands?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like when Ben...
I suppose that's a post-COVID response to, like, are you worried about the germs? Or, I'm fine.
Who am I wearing this mask for? Is this for you or is this for me? So, you know, and we see that he, we learned throughout the scene that he was a botanist, did he say, or an arborist?
Horticulturist.
And he's got a bit of a thing for orchids. So the room is, you know, humid in order to be able to sustain them.
My childhood pet had a thing for orchids. She used to eat it all the time.
Well, so put an expensive...
To the point where my mum had to dangle it from a tree out in the backyard because she just wouldn't leave it alone wherever it was.
Well, how specific.
I know.
And we learn that he doesn't like to go outside, but he wants to Donna to, and he says that ostensibly the reason he reached out to Donna was that he'd like to gift an orchid for Laura's grave.
Just on that point, almost at the very end of the episode, when Donna's back at his place and she's for want of a better phrase, fingering that red flower.
Yeah.
Part of me thought it was going to eat your finger or something, just be like
triffid.
Yeah, be a bit sort of Venus flytrappy.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I've seen it before, but I always expect her finger to get like cut or bitten or something from it.
Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
Feed me. He knows a lot about Donna because, well, from Laura telling mm-hmm. him. And I think it's interesting as well because this gets echoed again at the end of the episode. Because obviously she's been going through her whole wanting to be like Laura. And, you know, there's all of the jealousy and melodrama around Maddie and James later on in the episode. But I almost get the feeling that although he's a shut-in, Harold kind of represents, it's like the adult world to her.
Mm.
Like he drinks wine, you know, and you get the feeling that, you know, he's a bit of an intellectual and a bit of a sophisticated as well, you know. So
hey, Harold.
Yeah. So I get the feeling that that's kind of appealing.
You get all that from Orchids?
Well, just from Orchids, the way he speaks, the environment that he's in, the, you know, saltines and the things that he offers to her, you know, whereas like, you know, all of her friends drink like cherry Coke and milkshakes and stuff like that, whereas he's like drinking, you know, he's got like a fancy wine glass and he's drinking red wine. So he's just kind of...
I don't remember him drinking wine at all.
He is in both scenes that he's in. He's got a glass of red wine.
Has he?
Yeah.
God, I don't know. My eyes just completely blanked that out.
Well, gosh, when you quit booze, you quit booze.
I really did.
I can't even see it anymore.
I can't even see it.
And,
yeah, no, I didn't. I honestly did not notice.
But I think that that's a very deliberate design element. Are you okay?
Yeah, just realised I've still got half a Christmas pie on me.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
No, this is going to be a bit of editing fun, this one,
isn't it?
We see Cooper in the meeting room of the sheriff's station with the RBT on the blackboard. He's trying to piece mm-hmm. together all of these clues that seem to be coalescing. Albert briefs them, and he talks about how the long-haired man on their photographs isn't on any database.
Watch list or... Yeah.
He makes some crack to Truman, and Truman calls him out.
Knuckle dragging.
And it's one of my favourite scenes, this Albert's speech about how he rejects violence and he, you know, he talks about Gandhi and King and how the foundation of all of this is love. And he tells Truman that he loves him and, of course, puts his sunglasses on and walks out. And I love Cooper's line about Albert's path is a strange and troubled one or... But that's just one of those great nonsense scenes that makes Twin Peaks, you know.
Yeah.
And also just really well written in the same way that, like, Major Briggs's dialogue is well written. It's just so...
It's a pretty good way to sort of diffuse a situation pretty quickly because it's like, well, fuck. Like, it's quite hard to get violent with someone who just tells you they love you.
Yeah, and also, I mean, again, spoiler alert, from here on out, Albert's a really nice guy.
Yeah.
It is like he just changed his character.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like that happens to a few characters. And I think part of it is, I mean, Lynch likes to play with identity. But I think also part of it is a little bit of meta commentary on soap operas. And I think you get a lot more of that in the episodes that aren't written by Lynch and Frost or directed by Lynch or Frost. Because I think that a lot of the stuff in the media about Twin Peaks was that it was a satire of soap operas. And I think there's an element of truth to that. But I think that a lot of the staff writers really bought into that. And you would see characters in soap operas just change personality.
Mm.
You know, you would see characters who were evil turn good because the plot needed them to have happened. And I remember... Dallas would do that, and you'd see a rerun of an early episode and be like, oh, God, yeah, Ray was a baddie in the early episodes, where he's an angel in like the later episodes. And I think that...
I agree with that.
There's a bit of that going on with Albert.
Yeah. I mean, there is some of that, but I also think there's an element of the town gets to you in the end.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it kind of softens him.
Yeah, I think there's a reason for it. I don't think they're doing it purely for the sake of like meta commentary.
Mm.
But I think that the motivation behind that. I do think there is a little bit of commentary on soap operas going on there, just this idea that people just change.
Yeah.
You know, in soap operas.
Well, even sitcoms, like...
You're like, even Phil Mitchell. My beloved Phil Mitchell.
That's you mentioning him, not me. And quite frankly, he's been fairly consistent the whole way through.
Yeah, he has, hasn't he?
What was I going to say? The pilot especially, and probably the first half of the first season of Parks and Rec, Ron Swanson is a bit of an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, and not in a comedic way, in a I don't like you, Leslie Knope
kind of
way. And they're all extremely mean to her.
Yeah.
I
mean, sometimes it is just a show figuring itself out.
Oh, 100%. And they lean into some things and they completely rewrite other things. Like, I mean, Donna at the very start is nothing. She has no personality.
Are you talking about Donna in Twin Peaks now?
No, Donna in Parks and Rec.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, like just saying about how people can change characters and things, like it's not just soap operas that happens. Sitcoms, it's just a
natural part of ongoing storyline telling, isn't it? So we see Cooper basically says to James, it's okay, you know, when I wasn't you, go home, write some poetry or something. we learn about the wonderfully named Dick Tremaine. I love the fact that Dick says uses the word capital as well, quite frequently as well. I can appreciate that.
I love Hawk.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because he's got Andy's back, hasn't he?
Doing, you know, robots.
Yeah.
Prohibited.
And also you get the Dick sort of like, you know, oh, his people have, you know, enough reason to hate us. Although you do get a little bit of Hawk being hawkish. The way that they're talking about the giant, how big he is. And he's like, oh, he almost touches the ceiling. And Hawk's like, I believe the ceilings in the Great Northern are 10 feet tall. But the way he phrases that is just, it just sounds like, wise native guy talking again. We see Leland accost them, and this is an interesting scene. Leland accosts them in the police station to say that he recognizes the long-haired man.
Yeah.
And how he used to, that he was the Robertson family, and he lived in a white house, and he used to flick matches at him
And say, do you want to play with fire?
Yes,
little boy.
And Cooper's like, that's our man.
Mm.
And again, it's like, is Leland just, is this just Bob messing with people and making Leland fly close to the sun? Or is it that Leland doesn't remember, but he's getting some kind of repressed memory? Or is it that Bob is completely metaphorical and Leland is repressing? There's such complexity to it, and this just feeds whatever reading you want.
Smeagol Gollum situation.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually. Is it just the power of denial?
I mean, I think of Bob as being an actual person.
Yeah.
But then I also, I flip-flop sometimes and think, well, maybe he is just a spirit, you know.
Well, I flip-flop between those two things and thinking that it just simply doesn't matter.
Mm.
That it's just in the world of Twin Peaks, there's no line of division between reality and metaphor. It's just the same.
Yeah.
You know, there's just no separation there.
Mm.
It's very telling that Dick Tremaine doesn't pick up Lucy's fork when she drops it during the meal. That tells you everything that you need to know about him. James and Maddie.
And the fact that he just goes, preggers.
Preggers. And James and Maddie talk about Donna. And you know, it's his songs playing in the background during the scene because of his pain.
Yeah.
And he talks about, I just want to get on my bike and go. I mean, I remember when I was like 19, and I'd be with my girlfriend and I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to write a song about this. But they loved it. They did. You know, that's the thing is that
And then you married this cynical old bag.
The girls were just as vacuous and dumb about it as the boys. You know, we were just in different ways.
And then you you met me and I just took the piss out of
you. Well, you say thought, then I met you. Then 25 years passed and then I met you.
25 years? Oh, yeah, I suppose it was.
Well, no, actually, it wasn't 25 years, but it wasn't far off.
No. Shit, that's a bit scary.
It's the way that he's like, yeah, you know, I just want to get on my bike and go. And Donna sees them. And he's just understandably kind of shitty with them.
Yeah.
And she's like, why don't you just, Finn, hold hands and talk about it?
Why don't you just go and fuck each other?
And we see Audrey getting shot up with smack by Blackie and her crew. Audrey,
she's having a right old time.
She is. She's having a bad Tuesday. And it's the way that Blackie as well is like, because obviously that's essentially
what happened to her.
You know, so she's getting payback. We see the one-armed man selling shoes and he sees Bob's pick and has a bit of a wobble.
Mm-hmm.
He goes into the bathroom and takes his medication. Just a tad. We see Shelley saying that she won't say anything about Leo. And Cooper just kind of plays it nicely. And he's like, no, it's fine. I'm sure you'll have your loving husband. We'll be back soon to treat you the
and
way
you And she's so surprised that she's not being pushed into it.
Yeah. And this is where Truman and Cooper are starting to be. Because, of course, they don't know about Bobby. And I mean, why would they? It's not really of any, you know, meaning to them. But it's a reminder that all of these storylines are separate but not but connected in the way that the town is.
Yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
although we've seen it, it doesn't mean everybody else has.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we see, and it's funny as well because I always think of the one-armed man as Mike, but his name's actually Philip Gerard in the show. Mike is just the person he becomes when he doesn't take his medicine that seems to be repressing this identity.
Oh, my God. Is that what happened to Alex in L.A.? Did he not take his medicine and he just Mike signed off his email, Mike?
It was a cry for help.
Oh, God.
That's why I wanted to call our son Philip as well, because he's kind of like both parts of that.
Oh.
Of the identity.
Please tell me that that was not a consideration.
So, well, my next note is Philip drops his syringe and Mike comes out. and he starts calling out for Bob and says, I'm after you now. Did I accidentally turn the TV on then? I did, didn't I?
Yeah, old Bixby's. Trying to find Bob for you. That's disgusting.
I like the way that, and this does make sense, that Cooper assumes that Audrey saw him in the hotel, not in One Eye Jack's.
Yeah.
Because he's got no reason to think that she'd be there.
She was even there.
Because he hasn't remembered the note yet. Which, you know, how.
It's still under his bed.
Well, that's where the giant's final clue was you have forgotten something.
Yeah.
You know, because he got that and smelt it, but then he got shot and understandably somewhat sidetracked.
Yeah.
And it's a great scene between Cooper and Horn where Cooper's starting to ask him questions and Horn then starts to insinuate that there's more to Cooper's motivations. But really what Horn's doing is he's doing two things. He's trying to deflect attention away from Cooper's line of questioning.
Mm.
But also he wants to control every situation. He wants to feel like he's got some kind of hand, to use a George Costanza term, so, you know, the upper hand, and that by the end of it, Cooper is helping him because he controls Cooper, not because Cooper is doing it because he's a good person, because Horn can't even understand that.
No.
Or the only language he understands is control. And we've talked before about how he just loves the game.
Power.
You know, and you see all of his shenanigans, like with when he gets one-upped by somebody, he enjoys that as much as when he wins.
Well, it's like playing chess to him.
Yeah, he's just kind of
like, that's what they've done.
Yeah, well played. Mm.
Yeah, it is very much like that for him.
Mm. And so Cooper is understandably, you know, disgusted with Horn. We see Michael Parks as Jean Reno, great sort of B-movie exploitation actor, big favourite of Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, Kevin Smith. A lot of those filmmakers really like to use him.
Yeah.
But he wants revenge, basically. He wants Cooper. Yeah. and he wants to use Audrey as a way of bringing him in, kind but also base. He has designs on Horn's business as well.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of...
there's a lot more to happen there.
Yeah, there's a lot of manoeuvring going on. Mm-hmm. Cooper... Oh, go on.
Didn't say anything.
Oh, sorry, I thought it was, you were... Cooper talks to Truman about Josie and then finds the syringe in the toilet. Mm-hmm. Without chemicals, he points. So as you mentioned earlier on, a lot of these abstractions are starting to coalesce into, you know, real world... Yeah. Meanings. Ed sings to Nadine on top of Old Smokey.
I love the fact that that's the song he chose.
Yeah, yeah. And she breaks her restraints. And he's so demented. She reminds me a lot of the, you know, the wind-up clapping monkey.
Yeah.
And she's regressed, clearly, to thinking she's still...
a senior at high school.
Yes, that she's 18 years old. And you know, it's got to be said as well, but I don't think that... she gets a lot of credit, but I think that the physicality of her performance in a lot of things is really, she commits.
Absolutely. I think she's an amazing actress.
Yeah. And we see Jacoby's kind of tiki hut hospital room with his wife.
I found that scene so annoying. I was really distracted by the music playing like as Hula a bed music. Underneath it. I found it really difficult to focus on what they were talking about. I don't know. I just found it really difficult to kind of put that music to the background for me.
Well, I don't think you were meant to, because that was diegetic music. That he was listening, because he had those wave sounds on it as well.
Yeah, there was. She starts the wave sounds playing.
Yeah, but no, but he had that playing when they you hear that music go up as they walk in the room. So that's his kind of happy place music. Like, you know, he has it in his apartment, as well.
I just found it really hard to kind of zone in on it.
Yeah, but it was meant to be higher than the normal music would be in a scene of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, no, I know that.
Okay. So they give him some regression hypnosis.
Mm-hmm. I love the fact that Harry nearly falls asleep at the end of the bed.
Yeah, he's sort of getting lulled into a sort of soporific state.
It's like when I put Philip to bed.
And he talks about how he spelt burnt engine oil at the gazebo as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I know him, and recognises, Leland, as we will see. Donna goes to visit Laura's grave and gets pissed off that they're still cleaning up after her.
Mm.
And she says that they didn't bury you deep enough.
Voices her fears of losing James as well as Laura.
Yeah, and just being completely alone.
Mm.
We see James go to see Maddie because his mum's come home.
Mm.
And she's like, James, you're on fire. And his song starts playing again. I reckon he's got like a little tape recorder and he just sort of plays it every time he wants to emote.
And they have a little smoochy kiss.
Yep. And I love the way that when Donna comes in and sees them, two things about this that crack me up. One, he knocks over all the stuff on table and Lena's like, dude.
I did think. It's not even your house.
Yes, that's a reaction.
What the fuck are you doing?
And then when he goes out in the street, he's like, why? It's like, well, because you kissed another woman.
Yeah.
It's like, that's why.
I did think that is so like, poor me.
Yeah.
It's like the guy that sings in It Wasn't Me about how sad he is that he got caught shagging the girl next door. It's like, well, don't do it then. Just don't do it.
It's like when people cheat and then write it in their diary and their partner reads the diary. Like, you shouldn't have read my diary. It's like, nah. Sorry, mate. Nice try, but, you know.
Yeah, we're past that point.
Yeah, the fact that I read your diary means I was already probably suspicious of shit. Yeah. And lo and behold, I was right.
This relationship was already over the minute that diary was opened.
The diary is not the problem.
Yeah.
We see Maddie talking to Leland as well about how she wishes that things could be the way they are. And he's been really understanding and he's kind of like, well, you know, that life isn't like that. But then he talks... about, I wish it could be like those wonderful summers at Pearl Lake, which has a sort of, you know, ominous feeling about it, considering what you said before and the kind of, I guess, the implications of those scenes.
Mm.
I like the way that Cooper completely defers to Truman when they confront Leland.
Yeah.
And you almost see Truman look at Cooper, wanting Cooper to do it, and Cooper just looks at him like, no, this is your town.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to do
this. You're the boss. Yeah.
And, you know, it shows a lot of respect. And then we see Donna go to visit Harold Smith. Mm. She doesn't have a song that plays when she's all upset. And she sees and he's there with a really noticeable glass of red wine. And she notices that he has the diary of Laura Palmer, which was a publishing phenomenon in the real world.
I really need to go back to those scenes and just, like, get you to point out the glass of wine.
Any final thoughts, Hannah, before we wrap up?
No, just I think we've covered everything. I think it's just full steam ahead now.
Yeah.
Let's get going.
And I think the point where people are starting to, more and more people are starting to recognize Bob in some ways, is giving the show a real sense of momentum in the way that kind of counts.
Yeah.
Before you tell us about the next episode, couple of quick bits of housekeeping. Email appreciated at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com or comments on the YouTube channel and reviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And Instagram and Twitter, we are at rewatchproj. And check out our friend shows. So what are we talking about next time, Hannah?
Next time we are talking about Laura's secret diary. Yeah. The plot synopsis says Leland confesses to killing Jacques Renault and he wants to take a new sperm count test. Rumour spreads that a food critic is coming to Twin Peaks. John asks Ben to set a trap for Cooper in exchange for Audrey's life.
All right.
It is directed by Todd Holland and written by Jerry Stahl, Harley Payton, and Robert Engels.
All righty. Okay.
Oh, well, and Mark Frost.
Golly. There's a bit of a story behind the writing of that episode. There's a reason why so many people are involved in that, which I will bore you to tears about on the next episode.
Well, I'm sure we're all looking forward to that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Rush on back for that nugget that I've been storing in my head for 30 years. But, so we will be back to talk about that very soon. But for now, be well and send us feedback and we will see you
soon. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.